to kick this thing off. Can I kick it off? One, two, three, boom.
It's Mr. Lutz, and we're back at it again with another episode of World History Class with Mr. Lutz. And in today's episode, we're going to be placing our focus on classical Greece and classical Rome. Hard to believe I'm going to be able to squeeze both of those in under half an hour, but man, am I going to give it my best. So in the key concept connections for this chapter, I think what you're going to find is more a continuation of the earlier chapters that we've talked about than anything else, which is really focusing on key concept 2.1, which is going to be as states and empires increased in size and contacts between regions intensified, human communities transformed their religious and ideological beliefs and practices. And you'll see key concept 2.2 as well, which is as the early states and empires grew in number, size, and population, they frequently competed for resources and came into conflict with one another. I just don't really think there's a case to be made that there's all that much about key concept 2.3, which gets into the intensification of trade. I mean, sure, trade's mentioned throughout the chapter, bits here and there, but I really think chapter 5 is where Stearns seems to want to put it all together and try to establish some connections across different regions throughout the world at this time. So yeah, what we're going to do for this episode is I'll try to organize Greece a little bit chronologically and give you the patterns of governing there and talk a little bit about Greek mythology, and I do mean a little bit. And I'll do the same with Rome, just trying to give you a bit of a clear historical narrative. So as you're reading the book, it'll make sense where those finer details that the book talks about fit into the larger historical context. So here we are, chapter 4, and we've got one more left before period 2 ends. And if you haven't really noticed, we haven't seen really much of anything talked about regarding Persia. Chapter 4 is going to mention Persia so briefly. But I wanted to let you know that we'll talk about Persia to a greater extent in class than certainly the book does. And what we'll emphasize with Persia is going to be how they manage such a large empire through imperial bureaucracy, something called the satraps, through their infrastructural development, through their systems of taxation. And we'll also talk about some historical misconceptions that the Persians have often had to deal with, not personally, because their civilization doesn't exist anymore, but that their legacy kind of has to deal with as time has gone on. So the chapter really does touch on Persia, but it really starts with Greece. And one thing that you'll notice with Greece, which we're going to jump into right away here, is that they emphasize the importance of understanding the Greek city-state, that Greece is not going to be a unified empire. It is going to be very politically fragmented. And what that is owed up to, in large part, is going to be its geography. Its geography is important politically. Its geography to begin with is important economically. They're located in the Mediterranean, and the sea, the Mediterranean, is going to provide an economic lifeblood for these people who are living in a pretty agriculturally deprived area. The soil is very rocky, and just not suitable for the harvesting of grain. But what it is good for is for growing olives and grapes, which of course can be used for olive oil and wine. And I'm sure that you guys know that that's quite a popular thing, both of those throughout the Mediterranean region. And Greece has that stuff in abundance. So what that allows them to do then is to make exchanges for things that they're lacking back home, which could be things like grain or even timber and other goods that will really help them to thrive. So what they're going to do throughout the Mediterranean is build a trading post empire. That's what you'll see in ancient Greece. And then politically, what you're going to see on the very southern end of that Balkan Peninsula is just going to be a lot of fragmentation, a lot of different styles of government. And what that is owed up to is going to be the mountains. the mountains that run throughout this region are going to allow for the development of different types of political traditions, ranging from the standard type of monarchy to getting into an aristocracy, which is going to be ruled by the nobility, even oligarchies, which combines nobility ruling with wealthy merchants, or like I'm sure you guys have picked up occasionally here and there, hearing about ancient Athens being a democracy. And really, the strongest influencer in that type of historical political development is going to be the geography of Greece. And so there's two city-states in particular that your book focuses on, that I'm sure you expected your book to focus on, that, lo and behold, I'm going to focus on, and that's going to be Sparta and Athens. And I just want to kind of give you a rundown of Sparta and Athens and allow you guys to hear them both out and maybe draw your own comparisons, and maybe I'll toss in a few for you if you play your cards right. We'll see. So Sparta is going to really start off by being a state that is going to conquer some of their neighbors. And those that they conquer, they are going to make these people into what are known as helots. And these people, you will see the books and other sources you'll look at will really avoid throwing the term slave around, but these people are bound to their land. They are not free to live as they please. They can marry, they can have relationships such as that, but they have one purpose in life, and that is to work the land of the Spartan city-state and to provide the food for the state. And it potentially was a pretty miserable existence for these helots. They had to deal with state terrorism. They had to deal with random murders and killings and just living in a constant state of fear. Because what you have to understand is these helots, depending on the source, outnumbered Spartan citizens anywhere from an 8-to-1 ratio to a 10-to-1 ratio. And so the Spartans understood that if they were going to keep such a large population in check, they really had to force these people to live in fear. And what this is also going to lead to the Spartans realizing is to protect their state, they're going to really have to emphasize military training so that they can secure themselves. And so all Spartan males are going to have to devote their lives to serving in the military. And this starts right away at the age of 7 years old, going away from home and being trained in the barracks. And beginning at 20, you're actually serving for the military. Finally, at age 30, you can now leave the barracks and start raising a family and start living a life of your own while still expected to serve the military. So no, you're not done. So the question is, when are you done? Well, potentially the age of 60 is when you'd be finished your Spartan military service. And so the question goes then, who manages daily affairs? Who runs the show at home? And of course, then it's going to be women. Women are going to be the ones doing these types of things, and women will even have military training, and they're going to have a physical education. Now, are they considered equals to the Spartan male? Of course, no, absolutely not, unfortunately, at this time. That's just not going to be a thing that you're going to find in these types of civilizations. But we can certainly make the assertion that Spartan women certainly have more rights than other women in different societies of their contemporary time period. So now we come to Athens, and Athens, before it becomes this full-fledged democracy that we always champion it being, is definitely a place of instability and conflict between the rich and poor, and it's only through recognizing that changes need to be made to head off these types of conflicts do we really start to see Athens evolve into a democracy around the 7th century BCE. It's going to begin with establishing the idea that all citizens, regardless of their social status, are going to be equal in the eyes of the law, which is a pretty powerful thing to establish at this time. You have a reformer known as Solon later on who is going to further reforms, and he's going to end the type of slavery that you can fall into if you take on too much debt, simply known as debt slavery. So if you're a Greek citizen, Athenian citizen, I should say, and you simply can't pay back your loans, you could have entered what was called debt slavery as a way to work off that debt that you owe, but that's outlawed by Solon. And he's going to also allow government service to be expanded to any citizen who could financially afford to serve. There's four different classes of citizens in Athens at this time, and it was only typically the upper classes that could serve. Now what Solon is saying is, if you are well off enough that you can take off the time and serve your state, then you are able to do that because it was not a paid position at that time. And efforts to reform will be furthered by another leader named Cleisthenes, who will allow for any citizen to propose a law to be debated upon. And he also established the Council of 500. And in this council, any citizen had the potential to be selected for this council because members were chosen by what's called by lot, which means randomly. So you choose the correct lot, you're in. Welcome to the Council of 500. And so your ability to help govern the Athenian city-state begins. So we've got our feet wet with a little bit of an understanding of what ancient Sparta was like and what ancient Athens was like. And now what we're going to turn to is when these two states are going to kind of unify together in a battle against a common enemy. And this is going to be in the Persian Wars. And so the Persian Wars are going to be fought because Athens has decided to support Greek colonies, which are located in Ionia. And Ionia is basically today the western half of modern-day Turkey. And in this part of the world at this time, you have some Greek settlers there. Remember, Greece is a trading post empire. But what's happening in that part of the world now is Persian conquerors are moving in. And Athens is going to lend naval support because that's where they kill it in terms of military affairs, their navy. They lend naval support to these Greek colonists, and it fails. They don't really succeed in pushing the Persians back at this point. The Persians are going to win, and what's going to be decided upon is Darius the Great is going to decide that the Athenians need to be punished for involving themselves in this conflict in Ionia. So he is going to send a fleet to invade Athens and to destroy it as a result of their involvement in this conflict in Ionia. So what's going to happen is they're going to meet in battle, and the Greek phalanx, which is a type of organized battle formation that the Greeks are known for having, is going to really catch the Persians, who are a little bit less organized, off guard. They have more soldiers. They seemingly are going to be the successful group in this battle. But at this Battle of Marathon, the Greeks are going to win. But Athens isn't saved yet, and this is where you get the soldier Pheidippides, who is asked to run, think about this for a second, the 26 miles back to Athens to inform the citizens of their victory, which he does. So at the Battle of Marathon, Pheidippides is going to run back 26 miles to Athens, and he's going to inform the citizens of their victory. So there, yeah, if you put the pieces together that this is where you get the modern day marathon from, well done. Hopefully I made that clear enough for you. He's going to drop dead from exhaustion, but he served his job because Athens was able to spring to defense. They were able to secure and defend the city of Athens, and the Persians are going to sail by, see the defenses, and continue on their way. They don't want any trouble from the Athenians yet. 10 years later, Xerxes, the son of Darius the Great, is going to decide he's coming back to Athens, and he's going to destroy the city just like his dad had wanted to do. But Xerxes is going to run into some trouble at Thermopylae. This is where he is met by the 300 Spartans, where they put up their famous last-ditch effort to hold off the Persian advance, which they don't successfully do, but they are going to fight to the very last man. And this buys time for the Athenians to set fire to their city, so that the Persians don't get to conquer anything, don't get to secure the resources that they're after, and don't give them the sense of satisfaction that they've defeated the Athenians. So they're going to fight one last time at what's known as the Battle of Salamis. And this battle is a turning point in the war because the Greeks are going to defeat the Persians in this naval battle here. They have smaller ships that can maneuver more quickly, and they're able to hit the Persian ships with their battering rams. And you're going to see a handful more of Greek victories as this Persian war continues for several years, but ultimately the Greeks are going to win. And out of this, Athens is going to emerge as the leading city-state in Greece, and they're going to enter their golden age from this point. So the man you should associate the Athenian golden age with politically should be a man named Pericles. And Pericles is going to be the most important leader during this time. And that's because he's going to establish a precedent that allows for all Athenian citizens to participate in the government by ensuring now they're going to be paid for their service. So if before you were a male citizen, but you just didn't have the money to say, I can take off from doing my daily farming and go serve my government, that no longer matters because your political position is now paid. And that's a big deal. So this really expands the democratic process even beyond what it was before. And at this time, Athens is going to be the head of what's known as the Delian League. And this alliance is going to provide for mutual defense of the Greek city-states. And Athens is really going to push its weight around and establish itself as the largest power in Greece at this time. But the Spartans, jealous of that Athenian power, are going to form their own alliance. And this alliance is going to be known as the Peloponnesian League. And these alliances are going to be born out of a mutual fear of one another. The Athenians fearing the Spartans and the Spartans fearing the Athenians because they don't really know what the other has planned for themselves. And what you're going to see in this is you're going to see on both sides people advocating for dealing with the problem. In other words, fighting that supposed enemy. And in Athens, this democratic government is going to push for a war against Sparta because of this fear. And a lot of people are going to point to, you know, there's a pitfall of democracy. You've put the government into the hands of all citizens, and they're maybe making some misguided decisions here. And so, you know, that's one of the knocks against it in its earliest phases. But yeah, we're going to get a war between Sparta and Athens at this time, known as the Peloponnesian War. And this is just a 10-round knockdown, drag-out fight. And sure, the Spartans win the war, but really the key thing is to understand here, both sides walk out of this war worse for the wear. And they're going to open up the opportunity for King Philip II of Macedon to come in and invade Greece and take over and basically bring that golden age to an end. Because I first wanted to point out to you where I am right now in terms of your textbook narrative. I'll say for argument's sake, page 84. And on page 84, what you're going to see there in blue is this in-depth piece called The Classical Mediterranean in Comparative Perspective. Now, I don't want to read this whole thing to you or even give you like a massive rundown, but I just want to let you know it talks about what Greece was like at this time, but then it also makes it a point to compare it to India and to China as well. And it even discusses Rome a bit too. And that's the big stuff that we're looking for here. Remember, we're not trying to understand all these places in isolation. We're always trying to think about them. How are they changing or staying the same over time? Or trying to think, how do they compare with their contemporaries at this time? So again, my plug for you, read those in-depth sections. They're going to be super helpful for you. So in the fallout of the Peloponnesian War, you're going to have Greek philosophers really start to question the supposed wisdom of their predecessors and their institutions. That this, you know, they have this high point, and they've reached this low point. And so here's where you get men such as Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, who are going to urge the people of their time to live a life of introspection, where they're to look into oneself and figure out what do they need to do to live a life of integrity and virtue. And they really want to look at the world to understand human behavior and the behavior of the natural world through reason and logic. And their contributions that they're going to make in the fields of philosophy and science are going to influence European thought for centuries to come. And we'll see that. And we'll talk more about Plato and Socrates and Aristotle in class, but I don't want to discuss it too much here. And as a brief tidbit on the end here with Greece, I just would tell you that as far as the religion goes, they're going to believe in gods of the natural elements of the world, and what they're going to do over time is they're going to try to personify these gods by establishing these myths that explain how they interact with one another, how they interact with the world, how they make the world what it was. That's really the key thing, and again, we'll talk more about that in class as we go. So Greek influence is going to spread thanks to the son of Philip II. If you remember, he's the one who conquered the Greeks in the wake of the Peloponnesian War. Alexander is going to conquer an empire far beyond what his father could have ever imagined. And his empire will span all the way from Egypt in the west to India in the east. And Alexandria, the city, one of many Alexandrias, but the one that is in Egypt, is going to really be a cultural center here. So if we're going to talk briefly about key concept 2.3 and those exchanges, Alexandria is going to be the hub of, let's say, intellectual exchanges, because it's going to be home to the museum, which is going to be dedicated to the arts and sciences from throughout this empire, and also the library at Alexandria, which is going to have featured hundreds of thousands of papyrus scrolls of ancient literature and scholarship, and it's really the first research library that we're ever going to see in world history. And this is where you get all your favorites that you hear about in mathematics. Euclid, who contributed a lot to geometry, and Archimedes, who develops the concept of pi. These are the men of this time, the thinkers of this time. And you'll even get philosophical schools such as the Stoics and the Epicureans to emerge during this time. So still a lot of culture to thrive and flourish, even if that Athenian golden age had faded away. So kind of a hard transition here. We're going to move, as your book does, out of Greece and into Rome, and kind of just talk about the movement from a republic to an empire and kind of what that legacy is. Trying to avoid the whole fall of Rome discussion today, because chapter 5 will pick that one up. So Rome is going to start and emerge first as a kingdom in about the 8th century BCE, but I want to focus on when it turns into a republic, and that's going to be in the 6th century BCE. And so here's what you have to understand about what we're talking about with the Roman Republic. First of all, the concept of citizenship. In the earliest days of the Republic, citizenship is only going to be extended to free-born males. That's it. And one of the features that's going to define this early Republic, and for that matter, the entire history of the Republic, is going to be a struggle between the upper class, known as the patricians, and the lower class, known as the plebeians. The plebeians originally could not hold government positions, but in time there are going to be reforms that are going to allow them to elect people called tribunes, and these tribunes are going to help protect the interests of the plebeians. And also they're going to establish what are called the 12 tables, which is basically codifying or writing down Roman laws, as opposed to unwritten laws that are going to be subject to interpretation and ultimately the favoring of the patrician class. So ultimately, the Republican government is going to be led by two men called consuls. And these consuls are going to lead the army and the government, but they're going to be checked by the other consul, by the Roman Senate, and they could only hold this position for 1 year every 10 years. And here's an interesting thing. If there was a time of political or economic crisis, it was possible to elect someone known as a dictator. That's where we get that term from. And the dictator had the right to make laws independently, to lead the army, but the dictator had to be agreed upon by both consuls and the Senate, and they could only rule for a period of 6 months. So the Republic is going to be a time of early expansion, and really the highlight of them in terms of expansion is going to be in the Punic Wars, which is a struggle between Rome and the city of Carthage, which is going to be located in North Africa. And this struggle is going to last for 23 years, and it's going to be fought against this really famous general historically known as Hannibal, who attempted the improbable. He tried to invade Rome not via the Mediterranean, but by crossing the Alps. And there's a lot to be said here that we just don't have time for. Suffice it to say, Rome defeats Carthage in 146 BCE. They become the dominant force in the Western Mediterranean. And so that's really the highlight of the Republic. That's really its high moment, its high point. And we're going to get a transition into empire. So the question becomes why? Why go from a Republican style of government into an imperial government headed by an emperor who is subject to pretty much absolute rule? And really what it's owed up to is there's going to be a gap between the classes that grows. There's small landholders who cannot compete with the massive estates that are owned by the rich and they're worked by the slaves. So this is going to lead to joblessness and poverty. And some of the tribunes, especially the Gracchi or the Gracchus brothers, Tiberius and Gaius, are really going to try to reform land and do right by the plebeian class. But these men are going to be killed by their political enemies who do not want to see these reforms happen because it's going to come at the expense of the wealthy. And so soldiers start to see no opportunity for advancement anywhere else other than the military. And so these soldiers become super loyal to their generals because there is no other backup plan. There is no other way to succeed other than to tie yourself to your general and hope they can lead you to glory so you can witness personal success and glory in your own life. So one of these generals is going to be Julius Caesar. And Julius Caesar had become consul by forging an alliance. So he was a general who became consul. He formed this alliance that was called the First Triumvirate with a man named Crassus and another named Pompey. And after his year as consul, he went on and conquered modern-day France, which back then was known as Gaul. And he made himself the governor. So Caesar's becoming increasingly popular among his soldiers and even back at home after they hear of his successes. And this starts to ruffle the feathers of Pompey, who was one of the men who ruled in the triumvirate with him. So Pompey is going to try to do away with Caesar's power. Caesar is going to turn and march on Rome, famously crossing the Rubicon River, and they're going to fight a civil war against one another in which Caesar emerges victorious. And from that, he's going to take control of the military and the government. He's going to extend Roman citizenship to a wider base. He's going to create jobs, make pay for soldiers even more. He's going to even confiscate property from conservatives. So all these reforms are going to be at the expense of the former Roman ruling elite who were in the senatorial class. They're going to turn on him and they're going to assassinate him in 44 BCE. But his strongman style of rule is going to continue to live on, and he's going to be replaced by Caesar Augustus, who was the grandnephew and the adopted son of Julius Caesar. He's going to fight for control, and prior to his success, he's going to be known as Octavian. But he's going to usher in this period known as the Pax Romana, which lasts from about 27 BCE to 180 CE. And in this time, you're going to see a massive expansion of the empire, population probably ranging between about 60 to 80 million throughout, over 1 million people living in Rome itself. The Roman Empire is going to improve its tax collection here. They're going to establish a civil service, which can manage the food supply, mail services, tax collection, local governing. And so you really see this high point in Rome at this time that, of course, is going to end. But I really think that that conversation is for another day. So the last thing I want to talk about regarding Rome specifically is just going to be the role of religion in the empire. Originally, Roman religion is going to be much like that of ancient Greece. However, they're going to make offerings to the gods of Egyptians and Persians as well. And religion is actually going to be pretty flexible in Rome for the most part. Yes, there are exceptions. We'll get to those. Religion is going to be intertwined with the state. You have to worship in private. It's expected of you, but also in public. And even worshiping of the emperor is going to emerge as the emperor begins to increasingly see himself as a god in and of himself. But the problem where Rome is going to have conflict with other religions is going to be in public participation of state cults, showing that you ascribe to the beliefs of the Romans in public is going to lead to tensions with the Jews and later on the Christians. Rome could be accepting of different religions, but they had requirements and expectations. So Jews are only going to recognize their God, Yahweh, as God, none other. And they will not participate in any other kind of form of public worship. And that is often going to lead to difficulty in managing the Jewish population. And that's going to only increase, too, when Jesus of Nazareth emerges. He is Jewish. And the Romans start to fear his teachings because he starts to be one who could be seen as the savior of the Jews. And he emphasizes his kingdom of God. And that phrase, the kingdom of God, that could be interpreted as a strictly religious type thing, saying the kingdom of God is at hand. But that could also have political undertones. And it's hard for us to really be able to establish that. And it was hard for the Romans to really see which was which. So he is going to be executed by the Roman state. And as Christianity emerges, they're going to recognize one God just as the Jews did, the same God. And so the Christians are going to refuse to participate in state cults or recognize any other God other than their own. And so they're going to be persecuted heavily by the state as well until the 4th century CE when things will finally change in their direction. All right, so I'm going to make the last couple of sections of this episode really brief to keep us as close to 30 minutes as possible. I know I tried to promise that. It's harder to do than I thought. Not really. Anyway, taking up time. For the zooming in part, I wanted to talk about the concept of diversity in ancient Rome. I'm going to link a story to an article from The Guardian newspaper in England from about a year ago now that highlighted this controversy that had emerged in Britain over the ethnic makeup of the Roman Empire. There was a BBC cartoon that was published, and in this cartoon, it had shown a multi-ethnic Roman-era family living in Britain. And there were certain people throughout the world, but in Britain as well, who were outraged by this and said that it was historically inaccurate that you couldn't have this multi-ethnic family living in Britain at this time. It was just a ridiculous idea. And a professor at Cambridge named Mary Beard addressed the controversy and, in fact, argued the idea that, no, it was entirely possible, and it was, in fact, that Rome was ethnically diverse, both in terms of its population and its culture. And she pointed to examples of people living in Britain at that point from places ranging from modern-day Algeria to Syria to even Ethiopia, and she was attacked for it. And the question becomes, why was she attacked for? Why do people have such a hard time believing that Rome could have been multi-ethnic, let alone Roman Britain be multi-ethnic? And it really traces its way back to how people in the quote-unquote West conceive of themselves. And they associate ancient Rome with the legacy of Western Europe. And Western Europe they conceive of as being white. So these controversies that we have over nationality and race and ethnicity, they find their way all the way back to Rome. And if we can't have an honest conversation about what was Rome, ethnically speaking, then we can't have an honest conversation about what is this world today, ethnically speaking. And so I think there you really do see the value of history in a very direct way. So my advice for you today in the explainer is just going to be the value of pre-reading your chapter. Before you start going through it, make sure you do yourself a favor. Go through the headings of this chapter and you'll see titles of things like Patterns of Greek and Roman History, and then it'll go through Greece and Rome. You'll see Greek and Roman political institutions, Greece and Rome, religion and culture, and you'll also get Economy and Society in the Mediterranean. And as you're hearing those titles thrown at you, I hope what you're thinking is this chapter sets itself up in a very nice way to maybe do my notes in a compare and contrast fashion, to be actively thinking about those concepts while I'm reading instead of reading the whole chapter and then thinking of it after the fact. It's just going to be more useful for you to be making those comparisons as you read. Today's recommendation, if you can possibly stomach another podcast other than this one, is a really good one, much better than this one. It's by a guy named Mike Duncan, and it's called The History of Rome. And it is a multi-part series in which Mike gives you an excellent rundown of Roman history, all the way from the early days, the myths of Romulus and Remus, down to the collapse and the final days of the empire. It is fantastic. It's a good one for if you're just, doing whatever it is you kids do these days. It's a really good thing to have on in the background to get some knowledge about Rome if you have a particular interest in this part of the world, because here it is, a half an hour episode, and I didn't even devote the full thing to the Roman people, unfortunately. But yeah, that's my recommendation for you guys this week is going to be History of Rome, which is a podcast by Mike Duncan. Fantastic. He's got other ones, Revolutions. They're great. He's a really good historian, highly recommended. But I think I've said enough today. So that's going to wrap it up. I hope that this has been helpful. If you guys have questions, you know what to do. Get in touch with me and I'll talk to you and help you out. All right. Take care, everybody.